Welcome back, my friends, to AA Recovery Interviews. I'm your host, Howard L., and I'm an alcoholic. Sober since January 1st, 1988, one day at a time. I'm grateful you've joined us. AA Recovery Interviews is the podcast where Alcoholics Anonymous members from around the world share their extraordinary stories of experience, strength, and hope. There are over 145 awesome interviews in this podcast series. I invite you to listen to them all on AARecoveryInterviews.com and on all podcast apps. Today's episode features Steve R., whom I met shortly after he got sober in AA 13 years ago. Getting sober at age 58, Steve had been drinking for 35 years, with many opportunities along the way to acknowledge his overuse and then later abuse of alcohol. But like many who got sober later in life, Steve managed his drinking, mostly limiting it to binges on weekends and holidays. Though it interfered at times during his marriage and in his relationship with his children, Steve held his marriage together for 14 years, until his drinking resulted in divorce. He continued to drink and even attained success in his field, all while his increasing alcohol use caused deleterious consequences to his career and social life. Steve ultimately entered AA, though not necessarily to get sober. In fact, he hoped that attendance at AA would somehow absolve his need for the program entirely. Fortunately, he stuck around long enough for that attitude to change. As he attended more and more meetings, he discovered a solution to the problem he had been so reluctant to admit for so many years. By working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with a dedicated sponsor and continuously attending meetings, Steve has solidified his place in the program. Through daily prayer and meditation, plus constant work with new men, Steve's involvement in AA has become demonstrative of a program well worked. I believe you'll find Steve's story insightful and upbeat. So, get comfortable and please enjoy today's episode of AA Recovery Interviews with my fine friend and AA brother, Steve R.
Steve, alcoholic.
Yeah. Hi, Steve. That's the typical response people give in rooms here in Houston as well as around the world. Thanks for coming to do the AA Recovery Interviews podcast with me today.
Thanks for asking me.
And what's very cool about doing this interview in here right now is that you and I were just in a meeting in here, but since you didn't have a chance to share, what is your take on miracles in AA? If you had had the chance to share tonight, what would you have said?
To me, the miracle is not that we don't drink, even though that is a miracle. To me, the miracle is the fact that I don't have the thought of taking a drink. That's not even a solution any longer. We are miracles because the reason we drink is because we're alcoholics. And it took me getting in these rooms 13 and a half years ago to understand that. It did not matter how much I drank, when I drank, it's what happened to me when I drank.
So you couldn't predict your behavior once you drank?
Well, I knew it wasn't going to end up well, but that did not stop me.
Were you a blackout drinker?
Yeah, definitely.
What was that like?
I don't know. I blacked out.
But one of the comedians said that blacking out when you're drinking is like a time travel, that you wake up in another day and you don't know where you were, what you did, or is that how it was for you?
Yeah, I didn't know if it was, is the sun coming up, is the sun going down, what day is it? I had no idea. I was pretty fortunate in that I only had one jail consequence overnight, and wasn't even overnight. But, you know, I had whiskey dents, as we call them in our business, in my car. And, I don't remember having accidents, even though I'm sure I did. You know, I was a stay-at-home drinker, though, for the most part.
So stay-at-home, so was that at home before you went to work in the morning or at home after you got home or both?
Well, I'm a little unusual. It was Friday nights. Right. And I just figured out the other day that it was Friday nights because it resembled Black Friday. And when I was working in New York on Wall Street, after the markets would close on Friday, we'd go have drinks. Of course, there wasn't that many consequences back then because we had public transportation.
Oh, that's right. You could get falling down drunk and nobody could.
Right.
You would never get pulled over.
No, the only problem I'd have is, am I on the train going home or am I going back into the city?
You mentioned that 13 and a half years now. You told me one of your claims to fame, which I think is pretty cool, is your sobriety date. Is it 10, 11, 12?
8, 9, 10. August 9th of 2010.
So what was happening on August 8th of 2010?
I was at a wedding in upstate New York of my then significant other's cousin. And the next day we were going to go into New York to see my parents and my daughter. So, of course, like every good alcoholic, I had to negotiate how much I was going to drink that mm-hmm. night. And I negotiated that I'd have three drinks, which, honest to God, I did have three drinks. And my mind made me believe that even though they were in 16-ounce tumblers and basically ice, maybe one or two ice cubes, that that was okay. It took me coming into AA on 8, 9, 10 to find out that 16 ounces of basically straight alcohol is 48 ounces, which is a quart and a half of alcohol, which I now understand is a fairly substantial amount of alcohol.
And this was at a wedding, so it was on somebody else's dime.
Absolutely. And, you know, they were taking too long on the pictures. I still think it was the champagne toast at midnight that got me. What really surprised my significant other, who had been with me for 14 years, was that she thought I'd never disappoint my daughter, my adult daughter, and parents. And she was pretty safe that night. And that was not the case. And I did things that people who were sober would not do, some of which are too graphic to even get into it at this point.
Now, would you say that overall you ruined her wedding or?
No.
No, okay.
I ruined it for my significant other, for sure. But no, I didn't. The bride did not know it.
But so you were pretty conspicuous, but the bride was not as aware.
Correct, yeah.
So you kind of dodged a bullet there even on your last day, huh?
Yeah. I never made it down to New York City to see my parents and my daughter.
Oh, okay.
And my significant other said she thought she'd be pretty safe, knowing I'd never disappoint them. So I now know that what got me into AA was I actually got into AA to find out that I didn't belong. And that wasn't the story I heard at the beginning. You know, I wanted to tell my adult children, my significant other, hey, man, I went. They told me I don't really need to come back. There's no reason to. But I heard the miracle otherwise. And a physician with his, actually anesthesiologist with his scrubs on, with his name on it, told his story. And his story was what I would call my story on steroids.
Yeah.
So I said, maybe I ought to take a look at this. And I did. So what got me there was prove them wrong and what I now know we call pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I really felt bad. I really ruined the night. I really couldn't see my parents. And it was just bad all around. As a matter of fact, I did not see my dad, who passed away just about a year after I got sober.
Yeah, that's kind of sad when we miss the relationships because we were drunk.
To me, that's the biggest issue.
So 13 and a half years ago, how old were you when you stopped drinking?
58.
What do you think when you're sitting in a room like the one we're in tonight and you see all the young guys who've gotten sober, who are got, you know, 2 or 3 years and, you know, they're in their late 20s, maybe their early 30s. Have you given any thought to what your life would have been like had you not drank all those years?
No, I really haven't, because the fact of the matter is that's the past. I've given up all hope of having a better past. You know, I look forward to today, the rest of the day, tomorrow, and the future, one day at a time. That's the secret.
Day-tight compartments.
Absolutely.
Used to be referred to. That's not an uncommon story, but what's interesting about this particular meeting is that there are several men in it who are in their 60s and 70s who didn't get sober until they were in their late 40s or 50s.
I've seen a lot in their 60s. I see a lot before they turn 21. So there's no age requirement.
So how many years did you drink total?
35. And I actually started, when I say started, I mean I grew up in a state where you only had to be 18 to drink. So I was probably drinking at 14. Heavily? No. Solve problems? No. Probably when I got out of school. So about 23, and I drank to 58. So 35 years.
That's a long time.
That is a long time. And you had started to ask, have I ever tried before? And the answer is yes. And I didn't think I was an alcoholic because I didn't drink every day. There are still people in these rooms that are amazed by the fact that, how could you not drink every day? I just didn't, you know. I'm a responsible alcoholic.
Well, that goes back to what you said about proving that you weren't an alcoholic because
right.
of showing the way you drank compared with other people
right.
would indicate that. What was your family of origin like? Was there alcoholism in your early
family? None at all. Well, grandparents might have had it. My grandfathers, I don't know. I only know one grandfather. My mother claims that her father, who was deceased before I was born, was an alcoholic. I don't know if that's true or not. My grandfather, you know, we'd go visit him once a week or so, and he would send me to the grocery store to get beer for him, you know, six-pack of beer. So was he alcoholic? I don't think so, but again, I don't know.
What was it like growing up where you did?
It was pretty chaotic. You know, I grew up in a housing project, but I don't want anybody to think that, you know, that it was crime-ridden or anything. It really wasn't. It was meant to subsidize the guys who've come home from World War II.
And that was in New York City?
Yes.
Yeah.
In the Bronx.
The Bronx.
So now I've given away my entire identity. not that anybody didn't know that beforehand. But it was a housing project. We all did well as kids. You know, we were good kids. We didn't really get into any kind of trouble, into sports, obviously.
And how many siblings do you have?
I have two. I'm a middle child. Uh-huh. My oldest is a sister who's special needs. So I had to step up very early and become my dad worked at a grocery store. And so he was there 6 days a week, 14 hours a day, 12 hours a day. And so I became the provider for the household.
Mm.
And yeah. So it was...
From the time you were 14, did you say?
No, the time I was 8.
So you've been working a long time.
Long time, yeah. Finally gave up that work, though.
Yeah. What was school like for you?
I was an average student.
Average student.
Straight down the middle until I got to college. College, I did phenomenal. Graduated with honors.
What do you attribute that sudden rise to?
Being out of the house, quite frankly.
Really?
Yeah.
Were things that chaotic?
They were, because everybody catered to my sister. And the only way I got noticed was if I did something wrong. Yeah. Which, again, if anybody knows me, that's not a surprise.
Well, that's also one of the middle child things,
it is.
Too. Yeah, that's how it was for me, too. So you said you started drinking about 14. Do you remember what the circumstances were or where you were when you took the first drink?
Well, that wasn't actually my first drink. My first drink happened when I was 13.
Oh, okay, yeah, bar mitzvah.
Bar mitzvah, yeah. So we all drank whiskey sours. That was no big deal. But my dad, you know, we did eat dinner together as a family. And my dad would, my mother went to work, so we'd eat with my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd give me a sip of his beer. No big deal. I didn't feel anything, but... when I got to be a teenager and got to stay out a little longer, you know, four of us would chip in a quarter apiece and get Colt 45 malt liquor, you know, Saturday night. And then we would walk to St. John's Church where my friends would go in for a confession and I would hold the beer outside. But it was harmless. It was.
So were they confessing the same night they were committing the sins?
I never made it. I don't know if that sin carries to the next week or if it's, I don't know what's covered.
You got the special dispensation in that occasion.
I did.
Did you hang with a certain crowd when you were in high school?
Not really. I was a loner, and which is a fairly common theme. I was a loner and really didn't have a lot of friends. I wasn't a good athlete, so I was always picked last, and you know, just I mean, that's just the way it was, but I've had opportunities to examine it, write about it, as we call journaling. Mm-hmm. And not only did my parents do the best they could, but they did a terrific job considering their background. You know, they grew up in the Depression. And, you know, I was thinking the other day, so my mom passed about 8 months ago now, at age 96. And for some reason, it popped in my mind how she used to put her boots on and go to work at 6 o'clock for 6 to 10 in retail. Huh. Finish out that shift through the sleet and the ice and the snow and the cold and the rain and the whole bit, just so she could provide basically minimum wage to, you know, give us everything. We didn't have anything extra growing up, as you could imagine, but I never went without a meal. Back then it was steak and potatoes. That's what, you know, we didn't have the current price of steak.
Well, yeah, and that sounds very similar to the kind of home I grew up in. And see, my folks were first-generation Americans because their parents came from Eastern Europe.
Right.
And what they were coming from to what they encountered in the Depression, you know, things went from bad in Eastern Europe with pogroms and other things going on to coming to the U.S., the land of, you know, streets paved with gold.
Right.
But most of the gold that was paved wasn't theirs. You know?
Correct.
They had no purchase on that.
Right.
So you're running the streets of New York, or are you just kind of sticking your own neighborhoods?
Oh, pretty much my neighborhood. Yeah. My neighborhood ended at Yankee Stadium. Yeah, I've told many people this. You know, back then, half the games were played during the day. And go to Yankee Stadium, stay out of trouble. We didn't get into a lot of trouble. And if we did, we didn't get caught.
Your first encounters with alcohol.
Right.
What were your expectations whenever it was you took a drink?
I really didn't have any expectations, Howard. I didn't...
Did you get drunk?
I didn't think so, but evidently I did.
Starting... this is where the blackouts begin, huh?
Probably. You know, you know, this disease is progressive, meaning it takes a little more to get drunk, if you will, or high. And but sobriety is progressive as well.
That's fortunate.
And yes. And so I forget a lot of the things that happened. Now, when I sponsor others, I'm reminded of some of the things that happened.
So what was college like for you?
I was a good student. And I just pretty much did, you know, I would drink every once in a while. But when I went to school, you could either drink or you could eat. And I preferred to eat. So I didn't really drink that much. Now, again, some people may tell me that that's really not true, Steve. Do you remember this? Do you remember that? And the answer is no, I really don't. Did not do drugs. Growing up in New York City, I was very fortunate. I saw what people who did drugs did to their lives.
Marijuana, did you do?
Marijuana kind of came in when I was in college, and heroin, basically, you know, the junkies, as we used to call them.
You stayed away from all that stuff.
Stayed away from all that. Where I grew up was right outside an area in New York called Riverdale, which was a fairly wealthy area.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they had money, and they had drugs. I didn't have money. I didn't have drugs. So not having money was a plus. I never realized how fortunate I was that I did not have money.
So you got a CPA, you got a degree in accounting.
Correct.
And you mentioned going to work for a big accounting firm where drinking was part of the corporate culture, or?
I wouldn't say it was part of it, but on Friday nights you got exposure to the partners. You know, that's when you either made friends with them or you didn't make friends with them. And then I was doing traveling too, and you get an expense account. And my clients were basically in the hospitality business. So I got to eat in any restaurant I wanted to, drink in any restaurant. You drink at the bar, and they didn't know who we were. I was watching to see if they're ringing up drinks and what have you. And I mean, I was doing so much traveling, Howard, that it would not be uncommon for me in the mornings to call the front desk and ask them where I was. I had no idea. It didn't matter.
Did you ever drink during the day in those years?
I did towards the end. Mm-hmm. I started to, and then I put a little in my coffee, and then I'd have a client, and I'd already had some drinks, and that was another indication. But, you know, I could stop on my own. I just couldn't stay stopped, and I couldn't stop starting.
Yeah.
But again, I learned all that in these rooms.
Especially for us functional alcoholics, and I was one of those where I was able to get my work done but still go out on the weekends or go out in the evenings and tie one on. And I was able to stop at certain points. The problem with stopping is that it kind of convinces you you don't have a problem. If you can stop, you know, how can I be an alcoholic? I can stop anytime I want. Well, that doesn't address the starting part.
That's correct. And a lot of people have come up to me and said, I can't believe that that's all you did is drink on Friday night. And again, that's basically what I did. I you know, if you called me up on a Wednesday, I'd go out with you on a Wednesday, probably. We don't know because I might not show up. That was the, you know, wasn't a cannibal. I had to remember, and I heard early on, the fact that you don't drink every day and the fact that you might not drink like others doesn't mean you're not an alcoholic.
Yeah. Again. Well, 35 years of drinking is a lot of time.
It's a lot.
How would you characterize those years? Were there certain milestones along the way or issues along the way that affected you in such a way that you might have thought you had a problem at that point?
I had an employer say to me, and this was probably right after my divorce, you know, because he would call me at night, see what's going on, how am I doing? And I was in sales at the time. Mm-hmm. And he would call me and he'd say, you know, Steve, we have help for you. If you need help, reach out to us. We'll help you. Hmm. Of course, I didn't take his help.
How many years was that before you came into AA?
About 15.
You mentioned being married and then divorced. What were the circumstances there?
It was probably alcohol.
Yeah. How long were you guys married?
14 years.
Did she know you drank like you drank when you married her, or?
No, I really didn't drink. I married her out of school, so I wasn't drinking anything at that time. Now, that doesn't mean I didn't go to affairs and parties and drink too much. I might have, it just wasn't identified. It was more identifiable as you're drinking too much.
Did that come in the latter years of the marriage?
Oh, yeah. I was... This was during the heydays of Houston when everybody was drinking, was flying in the United States and drinking, going to the airport, drinking, you know, mm-hmm. first class lounge, drinking, first class seat, drinking. And again, I only realized that afterwards. It wasn't anything I realized at the time I was doing it.
Did your boozing contribute to the divorce?
Oh, I now know that it did. Absolutely. Because mm-hmm. I'd be out drinking every day in the gallery and then drive home to the 1960 area. I mean, it's the 2 o'clock in the morning. But I could get up at 6 and 7 and 8 and go be responsible. You know, I was taught that the job of a man is to provide for his family. And that's it. I can do anything I want as long as I provide for my family. And I did provide for my family.
That's your first marriage?
Only marriage.
Your only marriage.
I have a daughter who's in her 40s and a son who's in... his 40s, and three grandchildren, 7, 10, and 18.
What was their exposure to your budding alcoholism in their early years when they were children?
Well, I think it's affected my son.
In what ways?
We don't have a great relationship mm-hmm. today.
He blames that on the alcohol?
Blames it on the alcohol. Mm-hmm. And my daughter, we have a phenomenal relationship, and my daughter was getting married, and I was getting ready to walk her down the aisle. She said, Dad, you had one more drink left in you, and I would have never talked to you again. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. It's possible.
You came that close to the edge?
Yeah, absolutely. And she told me, again, that when I was down there for the wedding and the daddy-daughter dinner beforehand, mm-hmm. she said about my drinking. Yet the same young lady, daughter, who told me that when she had to come to me during, you know, every other weekend, she didn't want to. Mm. And she said she hated her mother for years for making her go. Mm. And my son didn't have to go because he was older.
So you got the kids every other weekend?
Every other weekend, mm. right. But the same daughter who told me about not speaking to me and didn't want to come over, this is the same daughter who called me about 4 years ago or so and said, Dad, I'd like to go out of the country for a couple of days. Could you come and watch the girls? And so I flew down to Florida and watched the girls, who at the time were 2 and 5. So that's come full circle.
Well, that's a relationship restored by sobriety.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And most do get, not all get, but, you know.
You hope they do.
You hope you do. And you know, we hear about amends in the program, and I'm a big believer in living amends. You know, how do I live my life today?
Yeah, that's important.
Right.
What was it like for you having the children before you got divorced? Compare that to having them every other week after. How did that affect the relationships and their growing up?
Oh, it was horrible.
Yeah?
Horrible. Ate me up. Whatever time I'd come home, even if it was 2 o'clock in the morning and drunk, I would run upstairs and give them a kiss goodnight. Of course, they were sleeping. And I couldn't do that anymore. And I was on my own. You know, I had nobody here in Houston, so I could do whatever I wanted to, anytime I wanted to do it. I used to go out to a lot of bars. Houston in the early 90s was, you know, you could drink for $2 a drink and all you can eat.
Yeah, happy hour.
Happy hour. And I, you know, happy hour at one of our restaurants, or bars, I should say, happy hour was like 2 to 9. And I didn't miss either any end of that.
I remember those happy hours. So you had a marriage within that time that lasted about 15 years. You had 2 kids who were coming to see you every other weekend.
Well, one was.
One was.
The other one would not.
How did that make you feel when you didn't get to see the one who you weren't able to see?
Well, you have to remember that's Friday night. Friday night's my drinking night. So I probably numbed it. You know, I didn't feel great about it, but he was 14, 15, and at that age, they're able to, you know, to decide for themselves whether they want to go or not go.
Did they ever come to you and say, Dad, would you not drink?
No, but they had searched the house several times when I was drunk. I'd pick them up drunk, you know, but they'd search the house and they'd swear I was on drugs, which I was not, because when I drank, man, I drank to blackout and, you know, whatever else they call it. I mean, I was comatose when I was drinking.
That's tough.
Yeah. I remember my daughter calling a friend to see if the mother can come and pick her up.
Hmm.
So I remember being at a ball game with my son and I was drunk honking a horn.
Yeah.
I got arrested for that, public intoxication.
It's a lot of shame associated with that.
It's a lot of shame associated with it. But that's not the way I live my life today.
Yeah, and that's important. It's important that you were able to restore the relationship with your daughter.
Absolutely.
And
I have a phenomenal relationship with our children. Just phenomenal. I talk to them probably 2-3 times a week.
That's great.
I talk to them on the way to this meeting.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk like you and I are talking right now.
So you have this living amend that is really strong for you with your grandkids and your daughter.
Absolutely.
You get out of college. You're married for about 14 years. You're working for a public accounting firm that's sending you all over the place. You're able to drink and do whatever you mm-hmm. want. You're flying under the radar wherever you go, pretty much.
Correct.
And did you work for that same company the entire time, or?
I worked for them for like 2 or 3 years. I was also, as they used to call it, a superstar. And so I can get away with a lot of things. But I didn't know I was getting away with a lot of things. But I could. And then I moved to Houston from New York in 1977. Stayed with the firm for 2 years more. And then I went out, as we call it, the private sector. And that was even a bigger party. And then in 1982, I went into financial planning, and that was even a bigger party. So, you know, I always traded up. When I'd go to dinner at night, you know, I didn't want to really hear about anybody else's family and all that stuff. So you drink it away. And again, I didn't know I was doing that at the time. What I like is when you sit in these rooms, in these AA rooms, people will talk about, well, I was in the oil and gas industry where they do a lot of drinking. I was in the metals business where they do a lot of drinking. I'm a lawyer where they do a lot of drinking. I'm a CPA where they do. Guess what, folks? They do a lot of drinking. And when I moved to Houston, I was introduced to a concept I'd never heard before called a roadie. And we were allowed to drink at that time. You could drink and drive at that time.
Open containers.
Open containers, exactly. Yeah.
We'll be right back. My friends, if you're enjoying AA Recovery Interviews, I invite you to check out my latest audiobook, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how more than 100 men have recovered from alcoholism. This is the word-for-word, cover-to-cover reading of the first edition of the Big Book, published in 1939. It's a relaxing yet meaningful and engaging way to listen to the Big Book anytime, anyplace. Have a free listen at Audible, iTunes, or Amazon. While you're there, search for my other audiobook, Lost Stories of the Big Book, 30 original stories from the first and or second editions missing from the third and fourth editions of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's also available from Amazon as a Kindle book or in paperback if you'd like to read along. You're going to love it. And we're back.
In what ways was the drinking woven into your career?
It always played a role in it. But, you know, we think that's the way to the top. It's not. Because, you know, you're bound to say something not politically correct to somebody.
Or insult the boss's wife at a cocktail party.
Absolutely. Or hit on her.
or hit on the
boss. I mean, that's even worse.
You sound like a man who's got some practical experience.
No, not at all. I mean, I was a responsible drunk, you know, in my mind.
Functional.
But that's that. You can't be a functional. In the sense that, yeah, maybe you can function, but I didn't hit my stride, you know. And has it caused me to maybe not be where I could have been had I not drank? Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. But it doesn't matter to me today.
What kind of effects did it have on your health?
I'm pretty lucky. I used to go to the doctor and they test my liver and I told them that they're looking at the wrong numbers. And I haven't had any liver problems. I haven't had any issues with organs health-wise. So keep in mind, it was binge.
It was binge, yeah.
And it was one day, virtually one day a week. Now, I have to tell you, one of my favorite holidays for several reasons is Thanksgiving. Part of it is you get 4.5 days off. That's a lot of drinking.
Can you unpack the lead up to your coming into the program, the period of time from when you were oblivious to what was going on in AA and everything else to you being acutely aware that you needed help and you went to AA?
I didn't come in thinking I needed help. If I thought that was the case, I probably wouldn't have come in. So, you know, I came in to find out that I didn't need any of this. I believe that God showed me probably the most important person that I could have aligned myself with, who's a very good friend of mine today and has about 23 years in the program, aligned me with him. I heard his story.
Yeah.
Had I heard the story, perhaps, this is not meant in any derogatory way, but had I heard it from a plumber, maybe I would not have related to it. But I heard it from a doctor, and I heard what his life was like, and I saw how he's changed his life.
Yeah.
And today, actually, he's working in the addiction field.
Which is great, and I know who you're talking about, and I've been in meetings with him over the years.
So I have to tell you this story. I sponsor a guy who has moved to Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
There is a VA facility in Tennessee, where this anesthesiologist, who again told my story, was doing his fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
So I hooked them up together. So I met him here in a meeting and got the opportunity to introduce him to one of my guys in a rural area in Tennessee. So here he is 10, 11 years later. During a fellowship, and I set him up with a sponsee, which he's their grand sponsee.
Isn't that cool? I'm curious. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking.
Correct.
What was your desire like when you first came into AA? Did you want to stop?
No. I just wanted the consequences to go away.
How long did it take for you to get from that frame of mind to the frame of mind where you were willing to admit you were powerless over alcohol and your life had become unmanageable?
It was pretty quick.
Was it?
Yeah, it was pretty quick. We have to remember I was 58 years old. I have life's experiences to a degree. You know, my profession, we expose, you know, we do what somebody would call an autopsy, and we expose things. And if you don't take action on that, if you find out you have a problem, you don't take action on it, then shame on you.
Right.
And so I followed my own advice, and when I found out I had a problem, it was immediate. It was immediate. And the more I went to meetings, I went every day. Went every day to at least one meeting. There were times I was going to 20 a week. You know, my first meeting would start at 6:30 in the morning. And I kind of believe that your success at 6:30 in the morning is pretty high.
One of my good friends years and years ago who used to go to the 6:30 meetings, he said anybody who's committed to getting up
Absolutely.
At 5:30 in the morning so they can get ready and go to a 6:30 meeting is probably pretty serious about wanting to stay sober.
Absolutely. You know, it's like working out in a gym. If it's 5:30 at night and you go, it's going to be really crowded, I'm going to have to wait for a machine, I'm tired. And I had a great day today, you know. You don't go. But 5 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, that's a great time. The world's quiet. It's just a beautiful time of day.
I get a lot done in the morning. But one of the things for me was I would go to a lot of, you know, I go to a lot of noon meetings and always have because I was in sales or marketing or I had my own firm and I was able to make my own schedule. So I could always schedule an AA meeting in the middle of the day. And the cool thing about that was no matter how bad my morning had gone or what my afternoon was looking like, that meeting in the middle of the day straightened me out from the morning and it prepared me for the afternoon.
Interesting.
And so that's why I still go to a lot of noon meetings. So you got in, you drew the connection to unmanageability and powerlessness pretty quickly, you said.
Definitely the powerlessness. Yeah, absolutely. And the other reason is I skimmed the big book and they talked about recoiling from a hot flame.
Yeah.
Well, on the way over there, I was saying to myself, on the way to my first meeting, I was asking myself, why is it that my granddaughter, who at that time was 3-4 years old, why would she only touch a stove once and never touch it again? And then I see this reference to it in the book. Yeah. So now I've got evidence. I've got this anesthesiologist. You know, I've got a reference to recoiling from a hot flame. There's probably something in that. And I was very relieved to find out that this is not a religious program at all. It is a spiritual program.
Yeah. Talk to me about that for a minute. You, like I, come from a little bit different religious background than let's say, the majority of people in these rooms. Mm-hmm. Seeing God in the steps on the wall was very off-putting for me when I first came in. I felt my whole life that people were, just because I wasn't of the majority religions, people wanted me to be, and I always felt like people were trying to force their religious beliefs down my throat. That was just how paranoid I was about it. But when I got to AA and I saw God, I thought, here we go again. But things were bad enough that I was willing to do it. What was it like for you?
I was relieved that nobody was going to tell me I needed to believe in their God. And you know what? If I chose to not believe in God, they were okay with that too.
That was my experience after having that initial repulsion, was once I realized that nobody was going to try and do that to me, that I was much more open. And these days, spiritually, I see how AA has improved the quality of my life for a really long time. Did you have a spiritual awakening along the way, or was yours of the educational?
Mine was the educational variety, you know. But I will tell you this. There are some people who want you to believe in their God in the program. You know, they stop after a while when they find out that you don't share the same beliefs. You know, I think I've probably met every religion in these rooms.
Yeah, as have I. What's interesting to me is that not talking about controversial things, not, you know, endorsing or opposing causes in that environment carries over. And I think that that's a good thing. That's one of the reasons why I think AA works so well is we keep those things at bay.
Absolutely. And, you know, as you mentioned, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. That's it. That's our primary purpose. We have other purposes, but that primary is far out there. And there's nobody who sits in these rooms that would not run to my aid if they could. And if not, they'll find somebody who can do it. I've seen it time and time again. I posted when my mother passed away, I posted a note in Facebook. And that statement got 500 hits. Almost everybody is one of my friends in AA, even people I don't know in AA. I've got friends in AA all over the world. Most of them I haven't met. Support, phone calls, texts, absolutely.
In your 13-plus years of sobriety now, what have been some of the benchmarks along the way that you can, the death of your mother certainly was one of them, where you got a lot of support. Can you speak of a couple of others that being in AA made the big difference for you?
Absolutely. Probably about 8 or 9 years ago now, I was going through a lot of anxiety. I refer to it as the gnats and the ants, just little things that add up and all of a sudden they become a big thing. Mm-hmm. And thank God, most of my stuff has been little things. And I found out, Howard, again, just my observation, is that people go out over little things, not the big things. Can handle the big things. It's the little things.
Well, you know when your ass is falling off, and you know where to go when your ass is falling off.
Absolutely.
But when things are going really well, and you start taking credit for them going really well, forgetting why they're going well, ergo, you know, you're sober and you're working a program. That's why I think a lot of people go out when things are going well for them as opposed to just because things are going poorly.
It's more important, I think, it's more important for me to go to meetings. Well, it's always important, but it's more important when things are going good, you know, because you can fool yourself.
Well, and plus a lot of the people coming in who are thinking to themselves, you know, I've been sober for 30 days and my life still sucks, and some old-timer like you or me comes into the room and says, what's going on for us? It gives them hope. And that's why the good stories about success and prosperity are just as welcome in AA. But you don't hear them as much because the prosperous, successful people have dialed back on their AA. We were talking about the anxiety that you had, and how did you get through that with the help of AA?
First of all, I let people know what was going on with me. It was at a men's meeting, mm-hmm. actually, a 12-15 men's meeting. And guys came up to me afterwards and shared with me what they've done and what they do. And one of them was an outside therapist who happened to have 30 years in the program at the time. So he certainly understood me. We are uniquely qualified to help somebody else because we've been through it. It's not a theory. It's practical.
Well, especially when it comes to other issues.
Absolutely.
When I started early on deciding that I would talk openly about clinical depression and about treatment being okay, I had people coming up to me all the time saying, thank you so much for talking about it. I always feel like I shouldn't talk about it. And my feeling is it's a significant thing in your life that's affected by your alcoholism and may have contributed to your alcoholism.
Absolutely. I'm told that our members in AA, about half of them suffer from a form of depression. And you've shared that with me, which has been very, very helpful. I've shared in meetings with others that my first sponsor, unfortunately, who was, I think, bipolar, but he certainly suffered from depression, he committed suicide.
Yeah.
And I share that with people. And Howard, I don't think there's one meeting where I've shared that where somebody hasn't come up to me and said, you know, I've been thinking about that. And that's a problem as well. We lose people to suicide.
That happened pretty early in your sobriety, didn't it?
2 years. He slit his throat in his parents' guest room where he was living.
Yeah.
And he had almost 10 years worth of continuous sobriety. He's one that carried the flag all the time. He would tell anybody, you know, we'd be in the supermarket and they'd say paper or plastic and he'd say AA.
Yeah.
You know, and it was very sad. We were very close. We weren't friends. We were very, very close.
Sounds like that was a real tough thing for you early on.
You know, it really was for several reasons, one of which is he lived two complexes down from me, so I see his house several times a day. So it's a fresh memory for me. But anyway, getting back to your question, so people came up to me and they helped me and the therapist, but the trick was to get it out, to talk about it.
Is that something that you found that you could do over the years?
Yeah, I'd never talk about my life anywhere else. As you know, I'm a loner. And I often joke that I don't like people. And I like my AA friends, though. I like my sober AA friends.
I have a friend who says alcoholism is a disease of isolation.
Absolutely.
And the cure is socialization.
The cure is we're lonely people, so we treat it by isolating.
During your sobriety, have there been any close calls for you?
No. No, I've got to. Well, that's not exactly true. I was thinking about it the other day. So, you know, I was eating dinner at, this was probably about a year ago, and I won't say it's a close call, but it was a thought. And I was eating dinner, and it was a very trendy place, and there were all these beautiful women around, and you know, I'm like, okay, here I am, you know, martini dry, you know,
yeah.
Make sure you rinse, you know, do you rinse it out and throw out the vermouth and right. I want to dry, you know, cause here I am. But other than that, no, I can go anywhere. I have a reason to be. And, I was 58 when I came in. There's a lot of advantages of being older when you come into the rooms.
Well, you do a lot of work with one of the halfway houses downtown, which we won't name, but they send a lot of people to our meetings, which is very cool. What has that experience meant to you?
Well, actually, it's what they call a therapeutic community.
Uh-huh.
And it's really good because they have, you know, they look at me and we don't look alike. We didn't grow up in the same neighborhoods. And they have certain beliefs of, you know, where I must have come from. And, you know, you must have been brought up in a very wealthy area. And then when they find out that I grew up in an area that wasn't dissimilar to theirs, you know, but I enjoy working with them.
Mm-hmm.
I very much enjoy working with them. And we get to host them on Sunday night, and they love it.
Yeah.
They love coming here, and they love the fact that we go there.
I like the fact that you do put out the word formally and as part of an announcement, but informally, that these are guys who need sponsors, these are guys who need direction, these are guys whose meetings need to be supported by AA being
right.
brought in, because I can think for as many years as that particular organization has been sending men, after they get out of there, a lot of times we don't see them again. I like to think it's because they're getting sober and taking their sobriety to other places where they live or work or whatever. But knowing one of the fellas who is really one of the success stories of that organization, and there are some others there too, who have some long-term sobriety now who went through that, we really get a chance to see that no matter how good the work is being done, this disease still claims an awful lot of people along the way.
It does, and they're amazed to see how similar we are. Yeah, that's one thing when they share about, they go, you know, you guys are just like us. And we are. One of the things that program's been able to do is build what we would refer to as a three-quarter house, so they don't have to go back to their neighborhoods. That's the problem. You know, one of the problems I see today is that getting hold of drugs is very inexpensive, the first shot. You know, I can give you the first shot free. It's kind of going to Mexico and they give you free tequila. It's the most expensive free tequila you will ever drink. And so, but they don't have to go back to their neighborhoods anymore. You know, they can, and a lot of them, we have people with 20 plus years sobriety that have been through that program.
Yeah, I think it's great. And I think the good thing about their coming, in the early years when they came, they'd all sit in a little group in the back of the room.
Right.
But over the years,
I tell them to break it up and spread around.
Spread them out. There were times when I would meet a guy at the door, and he'd go to sit down with his crowd, and I'd say, no, come over here, and I'd put him next to Larry or somebody else.
Absolutely.
And that's important. Regarding sponsorship, I know you're a big proponent of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What's that been like for you?
Well, I've been very fortunate. I've had the same sponsor for 11 years, and he's got about 21 years.
Yeah.
He's about 10 years older than I am. We've become good friends. Yeah, we become very good friends. We have dinner once a week for the most part.
That's great.
We probably talk two or three times a week. He has told me, and maybe regrets it, that there's no problem or situation that's too small for me to talk to him about. And so he gets a couple of conversations that he wish he didn't have. But, you know, that's what we do. Some sponsors are just sponsors. You know, it's like an employer-employee relationship. And then some sponsors are friends. And I become friends with him. I become friends with his family. I become friends with his son, who happens to have 8 years in the program. So it's, you know, we're a very tight-knit community, but you can do anything you want. As a matter of fact, if all you want to do is come in here and get sober and stay sober and keep coming back, that's good enough.
Sooner or later, the other gifts of the program and the other promises will start to infiltrate your psyche and just the way you look at life in general.
And, absolutely.
I think it makes a big difference.
Yeah. One of the things you have to be very careful about is to not let the gifts of the program take you away from the program.
You're right. I remind people of that all the time, and I know you do too. You're one of the more outspoken people in our group, which I like, because every group needs somebody who will say something when nobody else wants to say it, and I think you fill that role in some of the meetings you and I go to. My attitude has been over the years, I would rather say something when it needs to be said than not say it and wish I had said it.
Yeah, and sometimes you don't know what the right thing is to do.
Yeah,
you know, so you ask for help, you pray on it, you know, I ask people like you, my sponsor, other people that I think might have a better grip on a particular situation. And, you know, my hope is, I don't want to go through what I did last year. Last year, I went to 3 funerals, mm-hmm. of which they were young, I call them young children, they're not young children, they're young men who were in their 30s. And their parents were younger than me. And to see a parent have to bury their child, you know, it's very, very tough.
Yeah, we lost another guy recently to fentanyl.
Yes.
And you know who I'm talking about.
A lot of them.
A lot of them. And it's really sad, but it's good that we can bring a perspective that knows what the solutions are, as opposed to people who are just trying to think, well, if we cut the supply, if we do this, if we do that. The reality of it is it's the addiction that kills people. It's the addiction.
Absolutely.
The drugs and the alcohol are just methods to fulfill the system, or you know. But I'm so glad that you were able to do this interview tonight. I think it's going to be well received. I think there will be people around the world who listen to it. And if they don't already have the hope, maybe they'll get a glimmer of hope. If they've got the hope, it'll just, I think, infuse them with enthusiasm. And I like that. And I think you've done that really well tonight.
So, thank you. You know, if we just save one life, we're okay, because we don't just save one life. We talk about the thousands of people in these rooms. It affects thousands on the outside. It affects their family.
It really does.
It affects their coworkers.
Yeah.
You know, we just look at the millions of people who are members of AA.
Yeah.
But you probably have to multiply that by 3 or 4 or 5 when you add their families and people who are influenced. And you know, tonight, Howard, we probably had about 75 people in the room. I don't know. One thing I do know is none of them will get killed on the way home because they're drinking, and none of them will kill somebody because they're drinking.
And that's a good thing.
There's a lot of people in our program, and you and I know most of the same people, who wish they had one more chance to pick up that desire to come into the room. You know, we make bad decisions because our brain does not work when we're under the influence.
Yeah. Spoken like a man who has the personal experience to back it up. And I really appreciate that about you, Steve. And this has been a really neat thing to do. I honor your sobriety. I love you as a brother. And I'm so glad that you and I get the chance to go to meetings together. And finally, now you've gotten a chance to put your message out to the entire planet.
Thank you.
My hope is that as many people as possible will listen.
I hope so, too.
You just tell all your friends and tell each of them to tell one person,
right.
And that'll take up.
You know, it just takes one person. If I can help one person, again, I'm not helping that one person. I'm helping his family. I'm helping his wife and his children and his grandchildren and his mother and his father.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's, you know, this disease does not discriminate. It will take anybody.
Yeah, it'll take what it can get.
It can take what it can get. And, you know, if it could kill me, it'll kill me. And if not, it'll settle for me being drunk.
Yeah, I have a friend who says, my disease wants to kill me and make it look like an accident.
Thank
Steve,
you.
This has been great. Thanks so much for doing this.
And I'll
catch up with you soon.
Cool. Thank you, Howard. Thank you for asking me. Seriously, it's an honor.
Well, my friends, that's a wrap for today's episode of AA Recovery Interviews. I want to thank my guest, Steve R., for sharing his story. And thank you for tuning in. If you've enjoyed the interviews in this podcast series, please share it with others. This show is yet another helping hand of AA we can extend to alcoholics everywhere. If you want to contact me directly with any comments, questions, or suggestions, simply email howard@aarecoveryinterviews.com. Please also take a minute to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. By the way, this podcast strictly adheres to AA's 12 traditions and all General Service Office guidelines for safeguarding anonymity online. I pay all production costs. AA Recovery Interviews and my guests do not speak for or represent AA at large. This podcast is simply my way of giving back to AA that which has been so freely given to me. The next episode of AA Recovery Interviews is on the way, so keep coming back. It'll be here soon.